What's up, guys? FightfulSelect.com retro review. If you're watching this anywhere else, you're probably stealing it. Head over to FightfulSelect.com. We have tons of podcasts over there. Hey, we may release this free into the wild months from now, but for now, you got to be a FightfulSelect.com subscriber to get this. WWF SummerSlam 1992. Now, when I was a kid, this show was held in high regard, and we're going to see if it holds up. Today, I am joined by one Warren Hayes. You can see and hear him on the retro reviews, our G1 Climax wrap-ups, our 205 Live NXT review. Warren, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. And you see, today I even went ahead and I shaved. I usually keep a bit of stubble, you know, but today I pulled out the blades. I said, this is special. We're going back to 1992. Might as well look the part.
You want to look like 1992?
Not really.
That was a little confusing. So when I was a kid, I didn't get to order a lot of pay-per-views. It's going to be a recurring theme on this show is me saying, I didn't get to order the pay-per-views yet, yada, yada, yada. This was considered to me the Holy Grail. It was a stadium show. It was kind of outdoors. It had an outdoorsy feel. Was it outdoors? I don't think it was it?
Yeah, it was okay. Outdoors.
So it was outdoors. You had Bulldog and Hitman in the main event in what was considered at that point one of the greatest WWF matches of all time. And it was for the Intercontinental title, which is my favorite title as a kid. So this was the Holy Grail, and this is the first time I think I really went back and watched it.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite thing was that we started with an Ico Pro commercial. They leave those in.
That takes you back, right? But yeah, you're right. It is odd, you know. They'll blur out the numbers for the hotline and stuff, but they'll leave the Ico Pro logos in there. It's pretty funny.
They didn't want anybody calling it.
I guess not.
That could be tragic. But I still remember WCW's. It was 1-900-909-9900.
Wow.
They made it so easy to remember.
Good on you. I didn't remember.
Oh, that was the hook, man. I remember that stuff.
What I really liked at first, you know, they had they were showing audience, you know, the audience waiting outside the stadium, waiting to get in, which was really cool. And they had this one kid. At start, he must have been like at most 12, saying the British Bulldog is going to win whether he wants to or not. And I'm like, okay, how much money does this kid have running on the match?
Yeah, it was very stereotypical, the intros and stuff. And when I was younger, really the only exposure I got to the UK was WWE and whatever TV show I happened to be watching.
Mm-hmm.
So I just assumed everybody stopped and, you know, praised the queen and all this horse shit. Man, they were so stereotypical here. I hope that this isn't the basis of WWE NXT UK.
No, they're right. No, because the stereotype has changed. Now you need beards in the UK.
That's true. You got to be a bearded European white guy. Oh, man. So a lot of royalty jokes. We start off with Legion of Doom with Paul Ellering defeating Money, Inc. Now, I had heard of the fabled Rocco.
Yep.
I never got to see much of him in action. He was as dumb as they put him over to be.
I was going to correct you because you said Legion of Doom with Paul Ellering, but it's Paul Ellering and Rocco.
Yes.
I don't know if you know the story about this. Legion of Doom was... They were at the end of their tenure at this point on WWF.
I was a big fan of them. Months after, they just didn't remember Rocco.
Well, Hawk left because of Rocco. Hawk actually didn't even get back on the plane from England to go back to the States. That's how pissed off he was. So it actually turns out like John Laurinaitis stayed behind to fill in for Hawk, and I think Animal then at some point got injured, and they sent Crush in to fill in for the Legion of Doom for their other contractual obligations that they had in Europe. They were doing other shows around SummerSlam. So Laurinaitis and Kahuna Crush finished off the tour for the Legion of Doom. Kahuna Crush, right.
Kahuna Crush kind of worked with Hawaii, though, right?
Well, that's how I remembered it. In my mind, it was always Kahuna Crush because he was Hawaiian. That was his thing. That was the gimmick. Can you imagine your gimmick as being Hawaiian?
Yeah.
That's your gimmick.
Damn. That's rough. So I remember a story. I think Animal had actually burned his calf or something like that, riding the motorcycle to the ring. And his tights had stuck to his leg. But their shoulder pads look so badass here.
But, I mean, ventriloquist dummy aside, that was such a cool entrance. Yes. And they started it off like that. And like you said, like you were a kid. I was just about to get into my 20s. So I was still like pretty, I'd get influenced by these things nonetheless. You know, the visuals would get to me and I was like, wow, okay. And I love the Road Warriors. I love the LOD. Seeing them come in on their motorcycles, full Mad Max, you know, it just made perfect sense. It was really cool. But then there was the doll.
Do you think that Ellering was like, I know what we should do. We should get sled dogs. Because you know he's a big Iditarod guy, right? He races sled dogs.
Does he?
Yes.
I didn't know that. That's
apparently
awesome.
Very well. Apparently very, very well. He's a big sled dog guy.
You know, sled dogging, parentheses, is a lot more difficult than it looks like. Just this winter, I went with my family sled dogging, like, and like just normal, typical trails. Man, you're always under the impression that you're about to tip over. The dogs are really good and they're fast and everything, but at some point you're hanging on to dear life. It was nuts. So respect to anyone who does it competitively.
One of my favorite lines in this match was, quote, Irwin's no midget. He goes over 260 pounds, end quote. From Heenan after he gets body pressed. Man, times have changed.
This is vintage Heenan though, the whole way through. Like this is quintessential Bobby Heenan on commentary, the one-liners, the quips, the sticking it to McMahon. They had pretty good chemistry. It was no Gorilla Monsoon, but he had pretty good chemistry nonetheless with Vince.
So this, you know, it was a match. IRS applies a sleeper that seems like it went on half the match. Hawk misses a flying clothesline, gets beat up by DiBiase outside. And IRS drop kicks Animal to prevent the Doomsday Device, which in no way was DiBiase going to take.
No.
He wasn't taking one of those. But a power slam from Animal wins it. The match itself, it left a lot to be desired.
It was fine. You know what the problem, what took me out of it, seeing it now, were the heel tactics, right? It's like there was a lot of double teaming by Money Inc. And Animal was on the outside and he was like always coming into the ring. For some reason, there weren't any actual double team tactics being employed. But then for some reason, he just jumped into the ring. So the ref had come over and, you know, and try to push him out. And then the heels would double team. And I'm like, why do you keep going into the ring, Animal? Just stay out of the ring. It was ridiculous.
DiBiase in white gear. That was a little different too.
I didn't remember that actually.
Yeah.
That was really cool.
We see several interviews backstage. Ric Flair backstage teasing who's going to be in his corner or who won't be. Peak trolling. Virgil's cutting a promo backstage. We'll get to that. Well, no, we can go ahead because this is before. The volume goes up and down on this. It's so weird. And then he makes a too legit to quit reference and he does the too legit to quit.
And the way that he sprayed water on himself, it looked like his nose was running. Like he literally had two cascades of wet down either of his nostrils. And I also wonder, you know, like Mean Gene was interviewing Ric Flair and Vert, and it was Sean Mooney who was with Virgil. So I was wondering, you know, if that, you know, do the main event guys get Mean Gene? Then guys like Virgil end up with Sean Mooney.
So I just want to say, I looked it up. Too Legit to Quit had been out for a year.
Oh, yeah.
So, because I'm like, wow, was he making some like timely reference or something? No, he wasn't.
Well, but at the same time, it had like, let's not minimize MC Hammer's cultural influence.
Of course, he introduced me to hip hop music. I mean, I didn't know what it was before him.
Well, there you go. You know, and you know that's why we pray. We got to pray just to make it today.
Yes, that is why we pray.
That is why we pray. But so you know, even if the song had come out way before, I mean, it was being milked in all media at that point.
Regardless. Yeah, but think about this. That would be like me walking up to a girl right now, and my pickup line is, I'm in love with the shape of you. That song was out a year ago.
Well.
Man. Come on, Virgil. You got to do better than that. Well, what did we ever do to deserve the greatness of Sensational Sherry?
Oh, man, right? I know.
The videos that they used to set up this Martell Michaels match, where it shows Martell hitting, or Rick Martell hitting on Sherry Martell. Very confusing. Although she was just Sensational Sherry then. And her, like, kind of liking it was so great. She was so good at that.
But it's a common misconception, though, and I've read it on, like, sheets at the time. And, you know, especially when not back then in 92, because I was still too young, but later on when I'd read a lot of Scott Keith, even back then, a lot of people thought that Sherry Martell and Rick Martell were related.
Oh, yeah, that's not either of their last names.
I think Martell is, though, right?
No, his last name's like Viginalt or something like that, and Sherry's is Shrill.
It's Vigneault. You're right.
There you go. You're closer to Quebec City than I am. I'll tell you that much. This was to set up their match later, and Sherry says that they have agreed to not hit each other in the face. Phenomenal.
What a great stip.
Phenomenal. The Nasty Boys are backstage cutting a promo about not getting a title shot, and they're bummed out. And then all of a sudden, they just get really amped up because – I don't know. None of this made sense. I got to say this, though. I've never liked the Nasty Boys' work. I like their gimmick. Their personalities are cool. But, man, they have always had some good merch.
That's true.
Their shirts are really cool. Even when they came back to TNA, and I got a little bit of heat for an article that I wrote in 2010, before anybody knew who I was, I got one of my publishers' heat. Because I said it looked like Brian Knobbs was going to have a heart attack on the ring apron. And it did. They had those shirts that said, Nasty I Am. Those were badass, too. Those were very good. I mean, I'm pretty sure every vacation town ripped off the Nasty Boys paint slinging thing for a while, like 10 years ago. I saw those everywhere. So
probably.
The Nasty Boys talked.
The question that I had, too, as well, is were these segments pre-taped? Or did they fly the Nasty Boys to London?
London.
Just for the promo because they were not on the show.
I'm gonna look at their cage match to see if they worked any other dates over there. But also the Bushwhackers were there.
True.
Why? Why would you even do the pre-tapes with them? Man. I mean,
they were cousins. They were entertaining. You know, in the audience shots at first, you had one guy going like this, right?
How about this? Bushwhacker Luke worked matches last week.
I know. You told me about it.
Yeah, and the ref even chimed in and said, can confirm, I ref the match. Wow. You know, as we're doing this, I hate to put a timer on these. We're going to film TNA Unbreakable today as well. I was going to talk to Abyss, but they got pushed back to Monday, so no insight there. But I have talked to a few people that have been on this card, but I don't know if I ever talked about this card. As far as the Nasty Boys and why the hell they were there, I don't see them working any dates overseas. So if they did, oh, man, that's rough.
Yeah.
We got Nails defeating Virgil via technical submission.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
This is a – I don't know how this enters on your scale, Sean, but for me, this is negative stars.
So, yeah, something would have to barely exist for me to go negative stars. To go below 5 out of 10 to me is a basic TV match. It starts at 5. It slides up or down. And if it's offensive, it's going to land at a 4. If it's real bad, it's going to land at a 3. This landed at a 2.5 out of 10. It was so bad. By the way, LOD and Money Inc. got 5 out of 10 for me. You all can see those. I'll post those on Select. They will be up on Fightful.com. Just search for it. Nails made Virgil look like Luthez. Nails was so bad. Nails was worse than the jobbers that were supposed to be bad at Hardcore Heaven 95.
Oh, yeah. That's an excellent comparison. You should go watch. By the way, Select members, if you haven't seen it, you should go watch that retro review.
He looks like a guy who's been told what pro wrestling is, but has never seen it. That's how he sells moves. Look, he gets hit and he goes, wow!
And he was put directly into a program with a freshly minted babyface Big Boss Man, which right now we may scoff at, but at the time, Boss Man's stock was pretty high. And they were doing the turn to keep him fresh, to keep him interesting. And he was pushed immediately into a program with them.
He had a gimmick so effective he didn't need a title in Boss Man. And there's not a lot of guys like that. There are just some people, especially back then when titles didn't switch as much and there weren't as many of them, the term he didn't need the title really meant something. Today it doesn't mean anything because you have 400 titles. So if you don't have a title, there's probably a reason for it. Elias might be the only guy in that territory right now. Even Virgil in this match is like, what the fuck, man? You suck. I had ever seen Nails work before.
No, I don't think anyone did. I think they just saw a picture of him. He had worked in the AWA a bit.
Oh, wow.
Was it the AWA or in one of the NWA's territories for a while?
I'm going to look.
Another name, Magnificent Something. I can't recall.
I know he worked in New Japan later.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't believe. Yeah, it was in AWA, as I see. For quite a bit. He worked in New Japan before that, too. He was then out of AWA for years. And he actually worked a couple house shows in 85 for WWF. But had been with AWA dating back to 84 and spent like 4 years popping in and out of there. Oh, my God. He worked with the Von Erichs and the Freebirds in WCCW. How was he so bad?
That's what I was coming up with. How did none of this rub off on him? It doesn't make sense.
None of it. I'm looking at this, man. He worked the Rock and Roll Express. You know who his tag team partner was?
No, tell me.
A guy named Jake the Snake Roberts.
Never heard of him. Was he big?
The Rock and Roll Express. I'm upset.
But if you can find any consolation in this, Sean, you know, his only claim to fame after being so terrible in the ring for the short time that he was in WWE was to have choked out Vince McMahon, right? When he was asking him for more money. And he had, I think it was the Berserker watching the door to Vince's office in the venue where this happened, like John Nord. John Nord was watching the door and he just went in and he started screaming at Vince, choked him out. Of course, Vince fired him, but then he came back and testified against Vince in the steroid trial.
I'm getting more mad as I look at this. Okay, I'm not going to accuse myself of being a super worker, but in my second match, I was better than Kevin Kelly, who is Nails.
Yes.
Better than him.
Yes.
Better than him. And that's not saying a lot. Now, keep in mind, this was 7 years before this match. 7 years before the match we're talking about, Nails versus Virgil. There was a one-month period where Kevin Kelly tagged with Jack Victory, who was in ECW briefly, and Jake the Snake Roberts. You know who he fought or faced throughout that month period? How about this? Ricky Morton, Robert Gibson, Tom Pritchard, Dr. Tom Pritchard, Brad Armstrong, known as being a great worker, and Shawn Michaels. He wrapped up that month by facing the Fabulous Freebirds and then Kevin Von Erich later that night. A couple weeks later, he worked with Kerry Von Erich. I am upset. I am angry that he got so far on being a big guy. That's a sign of the times. I'm glad that those times are over.
That's what I was about to say, you know, because just when you were saying, you know, how did he get booked? Well, you know, Vince booked on looks.
Oh, he's so big, Pat. He's big. He looks mean. You know, you do that angry face. Snarl. Snarl, you big son of a bitch. Snarl.
That's probably how he went about it.
The only good looking thing was the punches from Virgil looked good, and he'd done a little boxing, I think, so they will look good, but Nails sold them so poorly that they didn't look good.
I was always a big fan of Virgil's candy cane tights.
Yeah. I liked Virgil. I mean, he was the guy that got mistreated by DiBiase, and it was a perfect babyface turn, I thought. Nails wins with a shitty sleeper. Nails gets the club out and hits Virgil, then chokes him with it. Okay. Rick Martel versus Shawn Michaels. I gave this match a 4 out of 10 because nothing
really
happened. I gave the antics an 8 out of 10. Another great Heenan quote. Look at the size of that mirror. So Martel at this point was 36 years old. And back then, if you said he's 36 years old, I'd be like, damn, he's at the end of his road.
Can I segue here?
Yeah,
I just want to name drop. I met Rick Martel when I was 10, 12 years old, because he's a hometown boy. I'm from Quebec City.
Okay.
And I met him at a food drive. He was in the AWA at that point. I can't remember if he was champ, because he was champ for a long time. I think he had the third longest AWA world championship reign. And he was at a food drive, a local food drive, like, and not just showing up. He showed up for the media, yeah, but he spent like a whole afternoon there. I was volunteering, and he spent the afternoon there packing boxes, just putting cans into shit and stuff. And I went up to him. I knew who he was because Montreal was a big wrestling market back then, regardless of, you know, we always talk about the territories, but Montreal was huge, you know, and so the TV that we got from Montreal here, it would bleed over here in Quebec City as well. And I went over to him, you know, and he was super cool. And, you know, I can't remember what he told me, but he told me something like stay in school, something like that. You know? But he was really, really cool. Montreal was a huge territory, which I feel sometimes isn't given the props that it needs, probably because of the language barrier.
Yeah.
You know, because of the fact that it was a little more insular here. But, you know, we got the Rougeau brothers came out of there. Dino Bravo, Martel. There's a whole slew of guys. Pat Patterson. Pat Patterson, by the way.
Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn for present day guys.
Exactly. And Kevin Owens to this day. But Pat Patterson, again, just on a bit of a sidebar here, and I know we're pressed for time, but we had the Montreal market was big enough for WWF back then to give us localized content.
Yeah.
And not like, so we had commentators in French. And by the way, the guy who was doing play-by-play at the time was Edouard Carpentier. And everything was localized for Montreal. It wasn't like something that, okay, we'll do in French, send it to France, and then it'll bleed down to the other French-speaking markets. No, this was like specifically for Montreal. So a lot of the segments that we had when wrestlers cut promos, Carpentier's color guy, I can't remember who he was, he'd like sum up, you know, he'd do like an overdub where he'd sum up basically what was being said, kind of like the guy who does the English translations on New Japan right now when the guys cut Japanese promos. So we didn't get things like, we didn't get Piper's Pit when back then. We'd get something else. We'd get Le Brunch de Pat Patterson. So Pat Patterson's Brunch. This was Sunday morning. It was after church. You'd go to church. You'd come home. You'd watch wrestling. And Patterson would have his own segment, his own interview segment. He'd have a table out. At first, there were a couple of cups of coffee. But as the years went on, he'd add baskets of fruit and croissants and cheese and shit. And then he'd invite legit stars, wrestlers to his show, the British Bulldogs, the Hart Foundation, Tito Santana, Junkyard Dog, Lou Albano, and he'd conduct the interview. He'd talk to the audience in French. This was the gimmick. He'd talk to the audience in French, and then he would ask his questions in English to the wrestlers. The wrestlers would give an answer, and he'd say, okay, give me a second here. I'm going to translate for the good people at home. And he'd just say complete bullshit. Most of the time there were baby faces, so he would just completely bury them without them realizing that he's doing it. Of course, some of the guys were in on it, most likely, like Albano. Albano was one of his most frequent guests, and Albano was definitely in on it because he wouldn't have popped up so much, and he'd call Albano a bum who sleeps in bus stations and stuff like that. Get Tito Santana to say that he hates Montreal or stuff like that. Yeah, no, that was really, really good.
I love it. You say we're pressed for time and talk about sidebars. We're going to have some sidebars on this one. The action was not plentiful on this show. So seeing Martel Kip up at like 36, as I mentioned, I'm like, wow. But now today, that's like prime age for a pro wrestler, as it should be. I mean, it's gotten safer. The rings have gotten better. And it's weird to see the career crossroads that these two are at, because while Martel would still be around in like 97, 98 before you'd have to hang him up, Michaels would be a champion about 4 years later, 3.5 years later. Martel had been a world champion in AWA about 6.5 years before this. So, and they would have become champions around the same time, around the age of 30. So the career crossroads is kind of cool to see. Martel tries to woo Sherry. Both of these guys are both just damn dirty cheaters, and their asses are hanging out throughout this match.
Wait, speaking about asses hanging out, we didn't talk about the elephant in the room here. It was Sherry Martel.
Sherry.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not complaining. That's why. Sherry knew what she was doing. Martel and HBK break the rules and slap each other, which leads to Sherry fainting and taking a great bump off the apron. If this match didn't have Sherry, if this segment didn't have Sherry, this would have been a total dud. Sherry made all of this. Nothing happened in the actual match. So Martel is giving her CPR. CPR. I'm trained in first aid. And I'm like, you didn't go through the steps you needed to go through, buddy. HBK and Martel duke it out and get counted out. Sherry's faking it. She looks up, then passes back out. And then when Michaels throws Sherry over his shoulders and her ass is hanging out, there's a Twin Peaks reference, somehow timely and not timely at all.
And you know the spot was for Sean to carry her back, right? And the fact that he slings her over his shoulder is entirely on Shawn Michaels, right? Like, this is him deciding, no, I'm not going to carry her the gallant way. Just flings her over her shoulder. And you could swear, I swear you could probably hear Kevin Dunn screaming at the cameraman to stay on the left. Don't go around. Stay on the on the other side of the camera. Yeah. Stay on the other side of Michaels. Stay on the other side. That was amazing.
Martel and Michaels keep knocking each other over. That gets a fake unconscious Sherry Martel to fall off. Like, this is so hilariously dumb and corny that I loved it. Like, it doesn't make any damn sense. Like, well, it does because they're both dickheads. And Sherry's just craving attention.
Finally, yeah, she's the biggest dickhead amongst them all, right?
Yes. She is the lead dickhead. They are just supporting background dickheads. Finally, Martel dumps water on her. I loved this. It was so stupid that I enjoyed it.
Yes, I agree. It was a lot of fun. I popped huge when Sean slung her over his shoulder because, like I said, I'm convinced that this was just Shawn Michaels adding his own little creative touch to this because he probably wasn't supposed to carry her that way.
Natural Disasters retain the WWF Tag Team Championships over the Beverly Brothers, who I completely forgot about. To me as a kid, they were super over, they being the Beverly Brothers. And watching back, they could work a little bit because they had to work around a Typhoon an awful lot in this match. Yep. Yes, Genius good in his role. They don't get any offense until Earthquake accidentally squishes Typhoon, and that leads to them working around a completely immobile Typhoon. One of the nicest guys in wrestling is Typhoon. Man, he just didn't move. He didn't sell. He didn't do a lot of anything. This was a rough watch when Typhoon was in there.
I agree. Shockmaster.
And Beverly's do the old drop kick body press spot where one of them body presses, I think it was Typhoon, and then Bo or Blake, whichever the hell it was, drop kicks his own partner to knock him over onto them. It was kind of cool.
Yes, it was.
I loved Earthquake's work, though. I forgot where Earthquake could get in there and wreck some people like this. His elbow drop, it was the first elbow drop I've looked at in a while and said, that was a hell of an elbow drop.
That was nice. I agree. And it also, and did he, was it me or did he hit a bicycle kick?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure, but it, you know, it sort of felt like he had that movement, you know, that sort of swing and the kick that you're supposed to have. I don't know. It kind of looked like it. I wasn't sure, but it was impressive.
He also does a great belly to belly suplex.
Mm-hmm.
That was really cool. A power slam and the Earthquake splash wins it. His run at the end took this from like a 4 out of 10 match to a 5 out of 10 match to me. It made it passable to me because of that. This was not one for the Typhoon highlight reel, but the Beverly Brothers and Earthquake, I thought, were outstanding in this match.
The Beverly Brothers, they actually worked in WCW as the Minnesota Wrecking Crew 2, managed by Ole Anderson.
Mike Enos, you know, was one of the guys in the ring, I think, when Scott Hall debuted for WCW. I think it was Mike Enos and Steve Dahl.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm pretty sure, at least.
I'm pretty sure you're right.
That's when they would take these people from WWF that they didn't need, and they would just put some weird name. I think his name was The Mauler or something. Ugh. Ugh. Like, why are you signing The Mauler and Steve Dahl anyway? What? We're going to show them.
Yep, that's those are big draw names right there. And you know, at some point the Beverly Brothers also use Lanny Poffo's Iron Scroll, right? Now, we're in 2018 right now. We've had a plethora of hardcore matches where we have seen the use of cookie sheets, garbage cans, coconuts, pizza cutters, all sorts of coconuts, right? I said that already. All sorts of different devices. But I don't remember ever seeing the use of an iron scroll as a foreign object since SummerSlam 1992. Grossly unrepresented. I'll get through it. Grossly unrepresented in the annals of great foreign objects.
4.5 out of 10 is what I go with for Crush against the Repo Man. This was, I look at Crush and I'm like, okay, I can see why they thought he would be a good guy to push. Because physically, he's reminiscent of a Hogan. He's a big son of a bitch. It's a far cry from Demolition for these two. I'll say that much. But, of course, there's no mention of Demolition Crush versus Demolition Smash here because Repo Man was not Demolition Crush. He was just the Repo Man. I was surprised by the number of people doing the Cranium Crunch at ringside.
No, but the crowd was – look, the crowd was hot for anything. And they couldn't have started off the evening better, honestly, than having Legion of Doom come out in motorcycles and then maintain that momentum the entire way. Look, the Wembley crowd was just they were ready for everything. They bought it all, hook, line, and sinker.
They did. Demolition, Kona Crush, Heel Crush, Jailbird Crush, Biker Crush, Brian Adams, Chronic. This guy's been through it all, right?
Yep. Quite a storied career, as in he's had a lot of stories.
And he was always technically the same guy, is the thing. It wasn't like he went from Papa Shango to Kama and they never referenced it. He was just like crushed the whole time and then became Bryan Adams once he left WWF.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty wild, man. That doesn't really happen a lot. Crush is surprisingly agile. He's also really strong, but he just can't wrestle. He cannot wrestle. And that's another thing. I was surprised that he could have been around this long and wrestled that poorly. But that kind of shows you where the big man was in that age. You didn't have to improve. Well, I mean, you didn't get like pushed to the moon if you did, if you weren't necessarily. I mean, he couldn't have gotten a main event push like this. Feuding with Randy Savage was as high as his career was going to go. I think it's pretty obvious they had pretty high hopes for Crush, too. And he was 28 here, too, which is pretty crazy.
Oh, really? He was already that old?
Well, I mean, I'm surprised he was that old because, I mean, he was, I guess he was 26 when he was
started with Demolition.
Yeah. But he just, though he was big, I don't think he was in the shape they needed. They had him out there in a singlet and nowhere near where he needed to be in the ring. He passed up pinning on a power slam and instead won with the cranium crunch.
And there's another sign of the times for you. Eh? These, you know, these claws, these pressure finishers. And it seems to me like, I don't know, but you know, you were young at the time. Were you like, wow, look at how strong this guy is. No. He might squeeze his head like a pimple.
Not at all, because I remember when he was in the WWF Raw video game, and I was like, that's a shit finish. I was like, that sucks. He's squeezing the dude's head. That looks kind of fun. It's like Alex has mentioned before. It's a vice. Nothing can break out of a vice. WWF Championship, Ultimate Warrior defeated Macho Man Randy Savage via countout, so no title change. This went way too long.
Yeah.
4.75 out of 10 it gets for me. Mr. Perfect isn't in either man's corner, as heavily speculated. Savage offers a handshake, but Warrior's super weird about it, and they almost come to blows. This is definitely each man's alternate attire.
Oh, God. Warrior's attire here is gross. And
I love it,
this kind of fleshy thing. Look, it's a preamble to Giant Gonzalez. That's the only way I saw it. It was a terrible.
Remember Mr. Goodbody?
Exactly. Slim Goodbody. Exactly.
Go. Remember his
I actually put that in my notes. The fleshy Slim Goodbody look.
Though the villain, the heel that would show up with all the candy in the shopping cart, looked like he was homeless. And I'm like, all right now. So this is pretty stiff early on. It's clotheslines besides a Warrior atomic drop. Savage tries to pull Warrior into the turnbuckle, but Warrior just falls down instead. So that was a thing that happened. Warrior no-sells one flying axe handle, but Savage says, oh yeah, and clobbers him with another one. Warrior was smaller than previous years and still huge by today's standards. And he still like caught Savage flying off the top rope with a backbreaker. I prefer seeing a Warrior like this to the heavily roided one. It makes me feel a little more comfortable, especially considering the guy died in his 50s of a heart attack. And, you know, I'm not a scientist, but you have to connect one to the other. And I wish this were the norm way earlier. Just not as copiously just that's heroin, not steroids, but in your ass. steroids. Warrior took the swinging neckbreaker like a real asshole too. I love that Heenan brought up how important the title was because Savage and Warrior both know how much money they can make with that title. That is important. That is cool. And then we got the shenanigans. What did you think about the matchup until the Flair Perfect?
Well, I actually thought that this wasn't so bad as far as the main event goes in WWF at the time, because they were sporting this as the main event. Let's not forget, even though it was third from the top down. I thought that this was one of Warrior's better matches. I thought he looked really good. I put a lot on Randy Savage, who could at the time work a fantastic match with a fold out chair. So to me, things were going really, really well. I enjoyed it and I didn't think it was all that long. I don't think we're exactly on the same wavelength here. But I think that the length of the match served only to expose Warrior's weaknesses more and more. At some point, Warrior is stomping Randy Savage in the corner, and he starts stomping him, and the audience starts counting along, you know, to get to the 10 count. And I don't know if Warrior was expecting this, but it sort of feels like, okay, I figure I'll go for the 10. And as he gets closer to 10, you can see he starts getting gassed. His kicks are slower and slower and don't have that torque in it.
I think that they thought Savage got the best match out of Warrior he's ever had, so let's put him in there for 28 minutes. Now, keep in mind, here are the other match times. 15 for LOD Money Inc., 4 for Nails and Virgil, 8 for Michaels and Martel, 10 for Natural Disasters Beverly Brothers, 5.5 for Repo Man and Crush. Ugh. So
at the time, this match was well regarded. Like, this was a down the line match.
And now today, boy, it doesn't hold up. What comes next is what we call a fuck finish. Because Mr. Perfect and Ric Flair come out as a double clothesline takes out Warrior and Savage. I thought this match was far too slow paced to have all these shenanigans, ref bumps, late pins, Mr. Perfect's interference. Perfect and Flair take out Warrior, but Savage doesn't see it. And I can't believe Savage felt comfortable hitting a pile driver on Warrior.
No, I don't think so.
I can't believe that's crazy, man. That spot even happened, because a guy who was at Warrior's level in the ring, there ain't no way anybody would let that happen these days. Mm-hmm. Of course, Warrior picks out of it, or kicks out of that, and a brass knuckle shot, and a flying elbow drop. Then Flair cracks him with a chair. How can Savage miss all of this? This is right. Nuts.
Because then he gets back in the ring, right? This is where he gets back in the ring, and he looks around, and he's like, he looks at all the damage. Like, he wants to go after Warrior, but then he realizes just by the damage what Flair and Perfect have done. And he's like, this isn't right. Which is kind of weird, because to me, Randy Savage, regardless whether he was, even when he was a baby face, he was always a little edgy, you know, kind of like Seth Rollins. You know, Seth, the baby face who doesn't mind getting that sneaky little underhanded tactic to get the win. You know, so it felt off for me to see Randy Savage be like, not take up an opportunity to win the match.
Yeah. Savage figures everything out and tries to jump on Flair, but eats a terrible chair shot and he's counted out. This match was WCW 2000 to me in retrospect. But at the time, I could see why I'd be like, man, this is cool as a kid. But this did not need to be this long. Warrior makes the save. This sets up a series of matches that they would do, but Savage would lose the title just days after this in a match that was so bad to Vince McMahon, he made them go out and redo it.
Yep. Oh yeah, you're right. I forgot about that. And there's actually rumor and innuendo. Look at me. I'm Mr. Conrad. that apparently the booking of the match was set for Warrior to turn heel.
Yes, and he refused.
And he just went up to Vince and said, I'm not doing it.
Heel Warrior would have been great. You know, we speculated about, why are the Nasty Boys there? Why are the Bushwhackers there? They were in a dark match. The Bushwhackers and Jim Duggan defeated the Mountie and the Nasty Boys. Also, Papa Shango beat Tito Santana. And there was a dark match that went on before the main event. Tatanka defeated the Berserker with Mr. Fuji. So,
God, I kind of sadistically want to see that. Tatanka and the Berserker? Are you kidding me?
Undertaker with Paul Bearer defeated Kamala with Kimchi and Harvey Whippleman. This was trash.
Oh, yeah.
Undertaker rides out for a very cool entrance in a hearse.
And this is 1992, and Taker is already getting these super cool entrances.
It takes him 3 minutes to get to the ring in a car, in a vehicle.
Well, you see, it took him 3 minutes to get it still takes him longer to walk there. It still takes him six times as long.
Kamala yanks Taker off the top rope, gets choke slammed, eats the signature Undertaker choke or clothesline. Ah, Undertaker goes for the tombstone, but Kim Chi attacks for the DQ. Lame. Why? You can't just have him finish him. Kamala does one of the lamest goddamn kicks I have ever seen.
The one when they were outside? When
they were outside the ring? It was to Taker's back. I remember that. Okay. Oh, Kamala slams Taker and then does some of the worst splashes I've ever seen. Where his feet, ankles, knees, hips, everything hits before his chest.
It was like a cloud falling on top of Taker. Just a soft, pillowy cloud of Kamala.
He manages to do one off the top rope, which prompts Bobby Heenan to say, "We have seen the end of the Undertaker." Undertaker sits up. This was bad after that entrance, man.
Cool to see all the Taker vintage Taker antics and spots too. You know, he did the top rope the top rope walk. He did it all.
I mean, I can say it's bad, but it was 3.5 minutes. I'd much rather it be bad at 3.5 minutes than bad at 10 minutes it to be mainly entrance and a brawl afterwards. And I guess you couldn't do the brawl afterwards if Taker just flattened Kamala. But eef, man, this was a period where WWE loved to do count out and DQ finishes on pay-per-view. And that didn't fly in a few more years. That wasn't flying anymore. What was flying was Bulldog and Bret Hart at the time. I would have probably given this an 8, 8.5 out of 10. It landed at about a 6 out of 10 for me, which is a good match, but it didn't hold up as well. But that's just a natural progression of pace and wrestling. For the time, this was an awesome match. Intercontinental Championship. Bulldog defeated Bret Hart to win it. This was the last time before Rollins and Ziggler that a singles match for the IC title headlined a pay-per-view. That's pretty incredible.
It is pretty incredible. And, you know, and I agree that, you know, because of the pacing and how things have evolved in wrestling, it's dated. But don't get us wrong, me and Sean, folks listening to us right now, you should see this match.
Yes.
It's history. It's incredible. And especially when we get into the context. I don't know if you want to get into that right now, Sean, if you want to.
The crowd, and of course there was the stuff with Diana. Now, I've interviewed Diana before, and she's a wonderful woman, and we've talked about this. You know, obviously her allegiance is going to lie with her husband naturally, and it did throughout this match. But the story was British Bulldog was introduced to Bret Hart's wife by Bret Hart. I will say this. You can tell when Bret Hart's going to lose a match like this. He got way angry and defensive. But the thing is, he had to play up being the heel a little bit more because of where they were. He needed to come off like a dick in this interview. He needed to come off like a dick a little bit.
And he talks about it in his book, too, on that level. You know, he says, like, but in perfectly Brett way in the book, you know, where he says something like,
Davey sucked. He was trash. And I had to carry everything.
Well, yeah, there's that. But there's also the fact that he said, you know, I was coming in. I knew the British public loved me. But, yeah, I'd probably have to be, tone it down a little because Davey Boy was the country boy.
God. Piper plays the bagpipes before this match. Cool. Cool, man.
But Piper could play the bagpipes. Yeah. That's the thing. He could legitimately do it. That's how he got over in the 70s, playing the bagpipes in California. That incident where when he was a heel and he was pissing off the Hispanics who lived in California. And then at some point he says, look, to make it up to you guys, I'm going to play the Mexican national anthem next week or at the next show on my bagpipes. And instead he plays La Cucaracha.
Diana is interviewed. She really plays up the fact that, you know, one's her brother, one's her husband. But in the crowd during the match, you can see her cheering for Davey because they have a camera on her. Mm-hmm. There's some chain wrestling, but finally Bret Hart uses the old kitchen sink knee and starts attacking him. The only bad thing I can say about this match is the horns in the crowd. Mm. Those were really annoying. Other than that, this was just a really nice match. There was a good bulldog on the bulldog. And then there's this happy accident outside that Brett has talked about where Bulldog forgets to catch him on a slingshot. Now what happens is Bret Hart slingshots and ends up doing a twisting slingshot version of the Orton backbreaker, where Orton brings their head around and then drops him over, drops his opponent over his back. Bret Hart spun through the air 360 degrees and accidentally grabs Bulldog's head and does that. And for the time, that is an accidental move, was one of the coolest moves I had ever seen in WWF, ever. That was awesome. I'm sure there's the Ricochets and Leo Rushes of the world who could choreograph that type of thing now. But that's the type of thing that you don't hit, but maybe 3 out of 10 times that you try it anyway. That was so cool. I like that. Bulldog goes through his signature spots, including the suplex and the running power slam, only for a 2. I always saw the running power slam as like a second tier move. Maybe it's because the Bulldog never got to the WWF Championship, but I mean, Braun's using it just fine now, and it worked in the course of this match. And it wasn't a protective finish. People would kick out of it, but it was a finish for quite a few guys in that era. Animal would use it a little bit. He would use the Oklahoma Stampede, and so would Dr. Death. But Bret hits a German suplex, not a move you saw a lot of back then.
No, especially bridging into a pin.
Yes. Davey answers with a superplex. This is really picking up now. A double clothesline, and they land on each other, which is not good for this because they needed to be apart. But from his back, Bret applies the sharpshooter. If anybody else tried to do this, it would look like total shit. Because the Harts are the only people I know who always their sharpshooters look good. The Rocks look bad. Sting's looks terrible all the time. All the time. The Hart families, there's always looked good.
Bulldog, the way he locked it in, I agree. It was like he was on his back.
Yeah.
Bulldog, I don't even remember Bret doing that after. I don't recall any other instance where Bret applied it than any other way than legs up, guy flying on his back. I've never seen that before.
I remember Sting applying it when a guy was on his chest and he just applied it and pulled up on the legs, which you can do. It's just it's harder to pull the legs up like that. Bulldog gets to the ropes and wins by countering a sunset flip. And I mean, to this degree, anytime I see somebody counter the sunset flip like that, I call it the Bulldog pin now. You see it so many times on highlights. It's his pin. It's synonymous with him winning this match.
I'm going to use it, and I'm going to put a nice little copyright on Ross Sapp every time.
There we go. Well, it's Bulldog's pin. This match was one of the most famous matches at the time in WWF history, and that's how he won it. Diana, Bret, and Bulldog hugged, and even Heenan was touched by this, which I thought was cool.
Yeah.
Even he was like, wow, look at them. What a family. And I was like, damn, man.
Yeah. Even Heenan, the whole way, was making jokes about Diana's appearance, right? He was just doing the one-liners, which he'd always do, you know?
Yeah.
Even with when Martha Hart was still with us and was accompanying Stu, you know, he'd crack on Stu and on Martha. But, you know, we've heard all the stories about Bulldog, you know, on how he went on his crack binge with Jim Neidhart beforehand and how apparently he came to Bret in the ring. They started the match. Bret had laid the whole match out the night before. Davey Boy comes in the match and he says, Bret, I can't remember anything.
Oh,
if you know, Bret to this day gets a lot of heat for a lot of things that he's done. Understandably, you know, it's Bret Hart. But if indeed, especially because we basically only have the testimony of Bret to go on this in his book, if Bret did indeed call the entire match from A to Z, was able to elevate it to this level, hell, he was even calling Davey Boy, according to him, was even calling Davey Boy to emote. That's how bad Smith was in the ring, allegedly. If Bret did all of that, you can, even if you don't like him, you have to respect this guy's knowledge and understanding of wrestling. His pure his pure, in the purest essence of it, because he made literally this entire match. And I had the book next to me while I was rewatching it and reading the moments where Brett had was saying in the book, oh, well, this spot happened. And then I had to start calling spots and it matches up like move for move. It's a phenomenal thing. It's one thing to take a guy through a match. It's another thing to take a guy through a match and make it one of the most famous matches of the era. So hats off to Bret Hart on that one.
Definitely historic. And like you mentioned, how that unfolded. It's a true testament to Bret Hart's ability in the ring. We're going to wrap up with some numbers. This did an attendance, allegedly 80,355. They, collected $2.2 million revenue from admissions. The company sold 1.456 million in merchandise, which is the largest revenue at the time from a WWF event. The buy rate was a 1.5, down from a 2.7 from the year before, but it was there was a trend of it going down. So this was, you know, considered a big success.
Mm-hmm.
And rightfully so. And we talked about the Undertaker Kamala thing. They would continue to wrestle through Survivor Series. Shawn Michaels was booked to beat Bret Hart for the championship on this show. It got switched around. Warrior was scheduled to turn heel at this show. It didn't go down. The nails thing came from this. He was upset about his pay. So this was an event that had long-lasting ramifications. Shortly after this, Flair became champion. Mm-hmm. Flair, who didn't wrestle on the show, the title picture was going into this show supposed to be something completely different. You had Warrior as a heel. You had Michaels winning the IC title. Who knows what Bulldog was going to do? Lots of stuff that didn't end up happening, and it's crazy to think where we'd be. Well, let's take a look how Dave Meltzer's star ratings matched up with my ratings. Animal and Hawk against Money Inc. Meltzer gave it 2.25 stars. I gave it a 5 out of 10. It's kind of middle of the road.
Sounds fair.
Nails versus Virgil got 1/4 of a star. I gave it, I think, a
2.5.
I gave it a 2.5.
I'm going to hold that over you, Sean, by the way. I think it's generous. We're going to discuss this again.
Oh, probably. It's got to be bad, real bad to get to a 3. Real bad. I think I've probably given less than a dozen matches under a 4 since I've started to cover them. And most of them have been on these retro reviews because the bar was so low.
Right.
I gave Martel and Michaels a 4 out of 10. Meltzer gave it a 0.5 star. Because, I mean, there was nothing happened to that match. Meltzer gave Earthquake and Typhoon a 1 star. I gave it a 5 out of 10. Now, that's just basic run-of-the-mill TV match. The scales are a little bit different. Crush and Repo Man got 1/4 of a star. I gave it 4.5 out of 10. To me, it got bad. It got sloppy, so it slid down that scale. But it was so short that it couldn't get too offensive.
Right.
Warrior and Savage got 4 stars. Yeah. Wow, I'm surprised by that because that actually did go backwards on my scale. And, I mean, that's just because it ran so long and had all those antics at the end. I just don't think it worked out well.
I wouldn't give it a 4, but I'd give it higher than what you ranked it. I thought it was better.
Yeah, to me, it just went so long and the weird antics at the end ruined it. I gave Undertaker versus Kamala trash. I didn't even bother rating it. It was so short, I couldn't rate it.
Wow. But
Meltzer gave it -1 star. 4.25 for Bulldog Heart. I give it 6 out of 10. Just, you know, I'm basing these on today's standards. Really quickly, as we wrap up, what are your long-lasting memories of this show?
I think it's a sign of the times. I think it's also, it's overall an entertaining show. And it's really interesting to see the new faces, you know, the Bret Harts and Shawn Michaels, Davey Boys, all the stars upon which they were building, Taker, to see where they were at this time. And that's really interesting. It's a bit of a time capsule. Big show for the WWE, something that is historically significant for them, but really it's a transition for all of their major stars that were going to that were going to explode within the months to come.
Guys, I hope you watch along with this. You share your thoughts, share your ratings. I want to know how you feel, whether it's a star, whether it's out of 10, out of 5. I don't care. Check it out, guys. It was a fun show to look back on. We are out.